The Kinky Cocktail Hour is brought to you by Motor Bunny, the world's most powerful saddle-style vibrator that offers fabulous creative sexual experiences. We use it and it rotates, it vibrates, and it delivers mind-blowing orgasms. Enjoy Motor Bunny as your favorite sex toy. When you order the Motor Bunny, multiple attachments are included along with the Link controller, which allows wireless control from anywhere. Motor Bunny is the world's most powerful saddle-style vibrator on Earth. Use the link in the show notes and spice up your sex life with a Motor Bunny. You're listening to Kinky Cocktail Hour, a conversation between adults about sex-forward relationships, kinky lifestyles, and frank communication. If you're under 18, please stop listening and visit scarletteen.com. I'm Lady Petra, and my pronouns are she, hers, and we.
I'm Saffa Master, and my pronouns are him, his, and we.
And this is Kinky Cocktail Hour.
Cheers! Okay, what are we drinking today?
I went and found a vintage cocktail.
I love vintage cocktails.
And it's actually a vintage American cocktail. So it's from the Pendennis Club Cocktail is what it's called. And it's an original recipe from 1939 by Charles Baker.
Okay.
And basically, it was invented at the Pendennis Club in Louisville, Kentucky. The brandy that is preferred is peach or apricot, and I use peach.
Okay.
And it was basically, this club was founded in 1881, and the cocktail was printed in 1939. So they think the cocktail was enjoyed before that point, but it wasn't printed until they did some kind of magazine or Gentleman's Companion later on. But it's interesting to look at how it's made and what it tastes like. And you can play with the brandies to change this. So this is peach brandy. And so let me tell you how it's made. Okay. Because that'll make a difference. So you mix all these ingredients together and shake it for 60 seconds.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter what order. So you're going to put two dashes of Pochard bitters. So that gives you that anise and licorice flavor. And then I use Rose's Lime, which because it calls for lime juice and simple syrup. So why not just use roses? It's more predictable.
Yep.
And basically what I used for that, because it's weird combinations, but I basically put half an ounce and then another 2/3 of an ounce of the roses to get to that number of liquid. And then an ounce of peach brandy, which we had.
Yes.
And we've used up our peach brandy.
Wow.
And 2 ounces of dry gin.
Okay.
And we will try it.
It's pretty. Is that the bitters that gives it that color?
Yes, because it's like hot red.
Mm. That's quite flavorful.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, see how the lime plays with the peach?
It really does. It's very fruity.
Like it really plays with the peach.
Yeah. It doesn't taste alcoholic at all.
It's a lot of alcohol.
I know.
That's like the sweet lady we had the other day.
Yeah.
These are dangerous cocktails.
Yeah. It tastes like lime juice.
I mean, my impression of vintage cocktails, Prohibition time or before, would be when they make a cocktail like this, it's really for the females.
Oh.
I think that's more inclined because most men at the time would have a scotch or whiskey, less sweet. This makes things more palatable. This is kind of a foo-foo drink, if you will.
A little bit.
But it's amazing how strong that brandy comes through. Yeah, I mean, this isn't a lightweight drink. This is incredibly strong.
I know, but the thing is, it tastes just like lime juice. And so,
with peach in the end.
With peach. But it doesn't really leave you feeling like you just had a slug of booze.
No.
So I think you can drink this and get hammered because you will forget that you're drinking alcohol.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's not bitter. It's sweet. But it has that sourness, you know.
Yeah, it's like sweet and sour. Mm-hmm. I agree. It's not bad. Not my favorite, but not bad.
Yeah. Today's conversation is brought to you by WeMinder, a behavior chart app for kinky couples like us. Learn more at WeMinder.app.
What's been really fun about this podcast over the course of time is all the different people we encounter around the world. mm-hmm. who are involved in kink. And we see sort of the commonality in the experience of individuals in kink with, you know, folks around the world that then aren't really connected to. But the same things keep coming up over and over again. And I met Mistress Adrena through Podophilius, who we had a conversation with. And I was mm-hmm. really impressed by the way he confronted his experience of shame and was able to express himself through her guidance.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, you know, we got to talk to her.
Yes, of course.
So, of course. Mistress Adrena, welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thank you very much. I hope I live up to the hype.
Well, we're delighted that you're here. You know, we always begin our conversation by inviting you to share your journey in sexuality. So why don't you tell us about how you discovered yourself as a sexual creature and then how that evolved up to where you're now operating as a pro-dominatrix?
Sure. I guess that's a long journey. I've always been a very sexual person, always. Even, you know, before I was sexually active, it was definitely felt very engaged as a woman and kind of felt that side of me developing. So I discovered kink, which has been, you know, really formative in my sexual identity quite early. I think growing up in London helped with that, because from about 15, I was wandering around town, visiting the sex shops, stumbled across, you know, all the old school kink magazines like Marquee and Skin 2, all of that, and just was fascinated by it. So I started to, like, you know, hoard all of these magazines, go to the kink shops, take all the flyers, learn about all the BDSM models, all of that. So it's always very much been a part of my sexuality, and it was doing that which then led me to go to kink clubs, I think at about 17. I was working them by 18 or 19, doing modelling and performing and obviously clubbing and socialising. It became kind of the backbone of my social life, and most of my best friends today are still the people I met in those clubs, still go to them. It wasn't a professional thing for me for a long time. I think from 15 to 25, it was very much something I explored privately. I kind of stumbled into domination by accident, really. I was working as a chef, and obviously that's really not good pay, and that's sometimes quite frustrating work. So I started doing these foot parties, which are essentially like strip clubs for foot worship. And I was doing that as, you know, a little bit of a side hustle, and it just steamrolled from there, really, to the point where within a few months I was so busy with it and kind of exploring different things within sex work that I could offer. It helped me to learn so much more about my sexual identity by helping other people to explore theirs, that it kind of really, that was a real turning point for me. And yeah, I've been in sex work full time, more than full time since then, really.
So how long have you been a pro dominatrix?
Oh, I see. I'm so bad with time. My guess is probably about 5 years. Possibly more now, actually. God. Yeah. I just suddenly remembered how old I was and was like, So yeah, no, I'd say 5 or 6 years. Yeah.
Well, age is just a number anyway.
Right?
Yeah. So as a pro-dom, have you found like a niche that you're really more interested in exploring?
Yes, I would say I kind of specialize in sensual and erotic domination. So very tactile, very touch-based, very intimate, and kind of say things like tie and tease, that sort of thing, really provocative, teasy, touchy kind of domination. More sensual than, say, focused around, you know, impact play and things like that.
Gotcha. Okay. You know, I learned about you through Podophilius. The thing that got my attention was he wrote down your rules as a poem. So two questions. What was it like to have somebody express your experience in a book as in the form of a poem? And then the second part of that is, I'm curious about just your experience as a sex worker. We're very interested in some of the concerns that exist around, you know, safety, security, availability, and that sort of thing. So I'm curious if you can just address those two ideas.
Okay. Well, obviously, Pod is amazing. It's really incredible to see his journey and what he's done, because obviously when he first came to see me, he was very new to it. Obviously, he hadn't started writing anything, and he's just taken off, and like really, you've seen his confidence just suddenly like blossom, and his creativity and the way he started to embrace kink and all aspects of it and write about it. It's really, I'm very proud of him, and it's amazing to watch. And yeah, it's really beautiful to read someone write about you that way and see you in that way, and to actually have a kind of document of how you have helped someone with their journey. It's really, I'm very honored for that. And I'm very glad that he found me, and I'm very glad that we could go on that journey together. Yeah. People always ask me how I protect myself and how I vet. And I think it's very different in the States to the UK. I think we're much more lax here. My experience in the States, because I tour there a lot, so it's people are much more, the whole references, every time I get an email about references from other DOMs, it's usually DOMs in the States. I take a much more kind of intuitive approach to it. So I'll always take a deposit, because if you take a deposit, firstly, you generally have someone's name, and it also kind of shows that they're serious. But predominantly, I do my vetting instinctively, and it's through how they communicate with me. So once you've been doing it a long time, you talk to a lot of men, and you see the differences between them, you kind of start to naturally pick up red flags or warnings or vibes that you're not comfortable with. And I'm lucky that I'm in a position, because I am busy and I do well. I can afford to say no if my gut tells me to. If someone doesn't interact with me properly when they first contact me, I won't, pursue that. I don't feel pushed to do it. So that is predominantly my vetting method. I always feel safe, though. I think that people on the outside, maybe I'm being naive, I don't know, but people on the outside often are very, very worried about your safety. But I very, very rarely have ever, in my own space, felt uncomfortable or threatened or had that sudden realization that something could happen to me,
So what are some of the red flags that you look for as a dominant?
Oh, gosh. There are many in different aspects of dealing with clients. And usually they're actually in themselves quite small and insignificant things that when you're doing it all the time, they kind of build up. People who, it sounds really stupid when you say it out loud, but like lack of patience. So if you get someone email you and 26 hours pass and you're replied, and you get a following two emails from them being like, did you get my message? What do you think of my message for that? Signs like that are usually, I don't know. That for me is sort of a red flag, because it shows a kind of lack of social awareness, if that makes sense. Other red flags, people obviously not being prepared to put down deposit. Big red flag. Men that want to discuss every single detail of the session with you over and over again before putting down a deposit. Red flag. And there are people who will just contact you and just want to go through that experience and will almost sort of live out the experience through a stream of 150 emails rather than actually following through the session. Yeah, there are many manners for me. I'm someone who is very, very particular about manners. Good manners. Someone who can string together a coherent email. That's very, very important to me. If someone just messaged me saying like, hey, I want a session, how much? That's kind of for me a reflection on how they're going to deal with you in person. And it's kind of it's like their level of respect for you and your time. And also it's initiative, like to think that if I'm going to meet this person and be engaged with this intimate thing with them and try and give them what they need to tell me a bit about themselves, what they're looking for, etc. And so the way that they do that is very, very important to me. It is the primary way that I make decisions when I see someone or not, is, how politely and how comprehensively they tell me about themselves and what they want.
Well, I have to say that when Poto shared the Ten Commandments, one of the first ones I think was grammar, punctuation, capitalization, what have you. That just resonated with me so strongly, because I just feel nowadays people are trying to be really informal in communication. And it puts me off. It just means they're half-assed in their communication. That means they're probably half-assed other places in their life. And it's just not appealing to me whatsoever. So I really love that.
That's really good to hear, because I sometimes feel guilty about it, because I do. Firstly, I love English. I love literature. I love the English language. So it's for me, and it sounds stupid, but it's like a respect thing, respect for the language. And when I see people disrespecting it, it hurts me. But I do feel kind of guilty, because I know kind of, although I guess it's maybe the beginning of their journey with me. It kind of scares some men when they're messaging me, because they're so worried that they haven't got it exactly right. And it's not like I need it to be exactly right, but it's just about that, making that effort, isn't it? to engage with someone. Just like if you met someone in public, you'd maybe shake their hand or give them a kiss or things like that. It's like that kind of effort to engage with someone and respect the time that they're giving you. And so, yeah, when you get, hey, how are you? No punctuation stuff, that does slightly hurt my heart.
So I'm really interested in this notion of psychological domination. I'm curious if you could elaborate on what you mean by that and how that works for you.
I can try. I think, I guess, in my head, divide, you know, you get what I call kind of the physical aspects of BDSM play, and then you get the psychological ones. So the physical aspects of kink would be things like impact play, corporal punishment, sounding, nipple play, that sort of thing. And then you get the psychological aspects of domination. And that's about, you know, engaging with people's minds as well as their bodies. And for a lot of people, that's, like, you know, integral to the experience. It's not just about you doing things to them. It's the, you know, the psychological sides of that. Just like you get people who are kinky, so people who enjoy the physical practices, and then you get other people who are submissive, and for them it's all about their relationship with dominance and submission. And so I always find that psychological domination would be a lot harder to engage with, because it's not this physical thing you just learn how to do. It's not something you can physically touch or comprehend, and, you know, it's other people's psyche. So it's, I find it's more complicated and harder, but it is more rewarding if you can engage with that. Examples being obviously like humiliation, cuckolding, denial, that sort of
thing. Can you talk about the process, say in the world of humiliation, how you ramp up the psychological domination?
So I guess, like anything, like with conventional sex, the better you know someone, the better it gets, generally, you know? And I think the ramping up is a good way of putting it, because it's that kind of slow development. Firstly, in, you kind of, you're tapping away at their psyche, aren't you? Like, you're getting inside their head. And it's, yeah, it is definitely a better process to start really slowly, to slowly kind of, it's like edging, you know? Every single time you bring it, but you bring them back down, and then you bring them up again, the intensity increases. The closer you get into the edge, and then you bring them straight back down, but the next time you bring them up, they're even more, they're like, nerves are more shredded, they're more, yeah, I don't know if that was coherent at all. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it occurs to me that there's two parts to psychological domination, right? You have the person executing the domination, which would be you in this case, but then you have the submissive, on the other hand, who's participating in this process in part because the arousal of their experience as a submissive is enhanced through psychological domination, such as humiliation. And so I can sort of see how the better you get to know somebody, the more opportunity you have to dominate psychologically. And I'm just wondering, like, where the edge of that is, like what the end point of that is, if there is an end point.
Yeah, good question. I don't know if there necessarily is an end point, you know. It's not something that's finite, or that, you know, tight enough that you can kind of physically comprehend in that way. So no, I don't think there is potentially any end to it, apart from potentially the end of the dynamic.
And then you also mentioned cuckolding.
Yeah.
So that's good. I'm interested to know how that works in reality, because from where I sit, you can't really be cuckold unless you're married or partnered in a female-led relationship. And as a pro-dom, I'm wondering how you experience...
That's a really interesting point, and it's something I think about and talk about quite a bit, actually. Because it is technically true. You know, cuckolding is the idea that... So you have a partner, and you are humiliated by your partner being pleasured by somebody else. So in that sense, you kind of need to have a partner. And there's always a part of me sometimes when I get requested for cuckolding sessions, it's like you're just wanting a free porn show, you know? Are you actually interested in the psychological aspects? When someone say that they're interested in pussy worship, it's like, is that pussy worship, or do you just want to, you know, eat me out? And I do wonder like that, what the motivation is. But I think it's more, the way I define it when it comes to cuckolding within a session is, it's less so much about the humiliation of seeing your partner being pleasured by someone else, but it's more about the role of the men. So I think the thing that defines cuckolding in terms of professional play is that you have the alpha male and the beta male. And their kind of humiliation and eroticism of it comes through then their awareness that they are what is called a beta male. So obviously a alpha males are the ones that fit into the conventional role of, you know, that kind of toxic male image of them being successful, them being big, them being well hung, etc. And a beta male is a man who is considered to be less of a man, inadequate, unable to please a woman. And so them seeing you as a man, the cuckolding in this sense is in terms of them seeing this woman that they can't have, getting pleasure by the kind of male that they'll never be. So that's how I see it in a professional play sense versus personal scenario.
And then you also operate as the key holder for submissives that you cage.
Yes, I do. Chastity is something else that I really love. I just completed Locktober, obviously, which is my favourite time of year. Yeah. Chastity, I still very much think, although it's that very physical aspect of it, of them being physically locked, it is definitely a very psychological one, because one of the things that I particularly love about Chastity is the way it completely, it's such an amazing way of controlling a man's psyche and manipulating it and retraining them. It's fascinating to see what happens when a man's attention is taken away from their cock and they don't have access to it. And it's fascinating to watch all the different phases they go through of like despair, then horniness, then euphoria, then total submission, then kind of often anger. It's really actually quite beautiful to watch. And, you know, after a certain amount of time, it really does alter their point of focus.
I'm really interested in this aspect of chastity, because you mentioned the cycles that the submissive goes through. And I'm curious, like, just as you look over your experience as a whole over the years, what's the biggest takeaway you have from that whole experience?
I guess it's fascinating for me to see, because I've never been in a position myself where I've ever had to deny myself sex or pleasure, or even, you know, like self-pleasure or that. And as a woman who I feel, as a whole, maybe have a better reins over their sexuality. I think that's predominantly the way female sex work is so much more of a thing than male sex workers, because women do have a bit more kind of control over their urges. And it's really, so when you first start it, you're like, oh, so you can't touch your cock, cry me a river. But it's really actually fascinating to see the massive impact it does have on them and the things they do go through. I have noticed sometimes, occasionally I'll become me myself, I'll get sometimes days where I'm like cranky as hell. And then I have an orgasm and suddenly everything's fine again. I'm like, oh, that was it. And it is really amazing to see how much of a man's kind of self-image or relationship with sexuality or his relationship with me, how much it changes depending on, you know, whether they're aroused, whether they've been allowed to come or whether they're locked. It's really, yeah, it's really eye-opening. It's something I encourage everyone to try. I couldn't say myself I'm not a man, but I really do think it does give men a really interesting insight into their own kind of sexuality.
What's the longest that you've kept somebody caged?
Oh, man. Quite a long time. Like, I had a guy who was caged for... So this was on and off, but in a year, he was caged for about 300 days. So he did take little gaps, but he spent most of the year locked. It was pretty impressive. I think the longest in one stint, probably about 4 months.
And what's the experience of somebody who's caged 300 days in a year compared to somebody who's, you know, just did Locktober, for example?
Oh, they're very efficient, apparently. Apparently it was brilliant for his. And this is something I hear a lot. I have a lot of my cage subs say that it really helps their productivity and output, which actually doesn't surprise me at all. I really think it helps them with their point of focus. And it definitely helps, I think, for people who are real lifestyle submissives. To be caged really helps you to focus on what is important, i.e. your dominant and serving them. So I find that overall it seems to have a very positive effect on their, obviously they always go through wobbles, like days where they really struggle, almost to the point where sometimes you can see them like desperate to get out of it, like to get, and then they'll have days where they're very, very emotional. It can sometimes make them quite fragile or emotionally needy, but overall, because I wouldn't do it if I didn't see from my experience that overall it seems to have quite a positive impact on their lives, both from the aspect of their productivity in their work and their relationship with me and their own sexuality.
This is a professional dominatrix question. So let's just say Locktober. You have a new client. You feel comfortable with putting a cage on, locking it away, keeping the key for the month. And so they've, in order to see you and to do that process, they probably had to purchase their own cage and then they had to pay a deposit and come to you, what have you. And then there's the process of you caging them, keying them, whatever else has transpired, and then they're gone, right, for the month. But we all know that's not necessarily what happens. Subs are sometimes extremely needy. And so how do you as a professional manage like the amount of contact they have with you after they're no longer in your one-on-one session, whether it's tributes or whether it's who knows how that's dealt with based on the volume they contact you? Or do you have clear delineation on how they contact you and what, or they have to pay another fee? It's really the logistics I'm curious about.
That's a really interesting question. And I think it's very different for everyone. I've never been very focused around, like, obviously when they come see me in session, there's a tribute, but particularly with subs where it's an ongoing relationship, like chastity, I never want to make it about the tribute. And so often, and if I interact with them outside of sessions, particularly if it's something I choose to engage with, there won't be a tribute involved. I'll never, you know, make people pay for extra time with me, etc., or make them pay to contact me. But I am very aware that therefore that does expose me to one of the hardest things about this line of work is that the constant exposure to people at all times, often even non-consensually, because they have your phone number, some of them, they have your social media, they have your email. You don't get to opt out. You know, I could be sat here on a Sunday night watching a movie and one of them perfectly innocently and with good motivations could be sending me WhatsApps or linking me to some video because they think I like it. And you don't have the choice to like opt out of that. And it can, just that constant contact and the constant need to be there for people can have a like a real impact in your long-term mental health. Like I was saying before, going back to, it's important for me to, you know, when you know a client better and you have an ongoing relationship, that's really important. That really helps the overall dynamic. So it is important to me to stay in touch with them, communicate with them, and to have those relationships outside of the session. So I'm learning about them and how they work and what makes them tick, rather than just this, like, you know, 2 hour period once every 2 weeks when I see them in my space. So that is actually important to me. And with chastity in particular, I would never, ever lock someone up and then just, you know, have them back to unlock them. For me, it's so important that it's a two-way dynamic and it's something you go through together. Because anyone could lock themselves up if they wanted to, but I can't imagine there is much satisfaction from doing it yourself. The satisfaction comes from having a key holder, giving it over your body. The whole idea is that you're sacrificing that for someone else as an act of submission. And so particularly if they're going something that they have like wobbles and emotional parts and stuff, it's really important that I'm there. So with Locktober or any form of chastity, if I say lock someone for a week, and I know that I'm having them locked for a week, I will have a tribute for that week, but I will make sure I will contact them every single day, because otherwise, what's the point?
So I totally get that. I think with access, that's just, you know, any kind of access they want. How do you, if it goes the wrong direction, do you just cut it off? How do you protect yourself from someone who...
And over-communicate.
Yeah, they're just going in the wrong direction. It's not going where you want, obviously.
Yeah, and that happens a lot. And it's something I think all DOMs will probably go through. There'll always be the risk of that happening. And it can really, really impact on you. It can have quite a negative impact on you. And so therefore, it's something that I am actually very careful with. And it's going back to the thing of red flags, you know, like you have certain warning signs of behaviors that you notice as being potentially worrying. Like I said, I personally, even outside of the context of a DS relationship, I would very rarely message someone after 10 p.m. at night. I would be unlikely to, unless I was like, you know, just WhatsApping a mate. I probably wouldn't contact someone on a Sunday. Just things like that, about giving people their own personal space. And so if you notice that someone is texting you at 2 in the morning, that's a red flag for me. Or texting you all day, or sending you little links to videos or cat memes or something, where it's like, are you actually communicating with, or is this a kind of, you're communicating at me? Things like if they get sulky, if you don't reply, stuff like that. They're all little red flags. And I will always give people a couple of chances, but I am quite strict with it. So I will always, I hope politely, you know, say to them, this is when you can contact me, or this. And with subsequently regularly, I'll say to them, you're always welcome to text me. If I don't want to, you know, if I'm not in a place where I want to talk to you, I just won't reply. And I'll reply when I can. And that in a way gives me a bit of my autonomy back, because they can text me. And if I'm having a drink with a friend, I just won't reply. And I won't feel obliged to reply until I'm ready to. So I will always try and give them some warnings. But if someone does continue to encroach on my private or personal space or take from me more than I can give them, then yeah, I will probably pull back from that. And yeah, they'd get a lot less of me.
I love that. I love that because that's the reality of the situation. And one of the things that I'm in discovery on is what, after I've vetted somebody, what I want as service to me. Granted, there are things that I think are enjoyable and quaint and amusing and would keep my attention for a period of time. But then I may have other long-term things that I'm interested in. And that it's interesting how when you have this title of dominant at some level, whether it's professional or not, they think you're a one-stop shop for everything. Even if you have your limits listed in your softs or your things you're interested in, it's amazing how they think, well, you'll do everything that I need. And I'm like, no, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. I can totally get that.
Well, I mean, it's open season on your time when you sort of give people your socials and your numbers and so forth. So there, it really is important to establish those boundaries because, you know, what you're really speaking about is consent. Like your consent's being violated if people are over-communicating with you outside of your agreed communication parameters, you know. And so I think one of the things I love about kink, just in general, compared to the vanilla world, is how much of the relationship, whether it's a private kink dynamic or whether it's a pro kink dynamic, how much of it lives in the world of agreements and negotiation and so forth. So I think you're just speaking to just one aspect of that.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And that's, I think the consent thing is something that I'm struck by quite a lot. People don't realize how they can be violating your consent so easily without knowing it. Like quite a lot of the time, for example, I'll get a man on social media, just send me a photo of him dressed as a French maid with his legs spread open or something. And he obviously, that's his kink thing. He's turned on. He thinks he's showing me that he's a sub. But for me, it's like, you've just sent me without my consent, a picture of your spread open body. Like that was a violation of my space and a violation of me. And if you didn't say, hey, can I send you this? That was not consensual behavior. I think all those kind of little subtleties, when you're exposed to it all day, every day, you become much more sensitive to it. And it's things that other people won't necessarily even really think about.
Well, and that's fascinating because I totally agree with that. You know, the unsolicited dick pic, you know, why do I need that? Even with my current vetting, subs have been overly excited and said, I did this and I can send you a full body shot if you want. And I say, I didn't ask for that.
That is it, so, isn't it? It's overexcitement, I think, most of the time. They're just like puppies and you can only see it. They're just wagging their tails, but like a puppy, you need to train it out of them.
That's exactly right. I train them out of that behavior and say, if I want something, I'll ask for it. I think they're wound up. There's also a group subset that's wound up in thinking that because they're male and they've chosen to be submissive and I'm a female that is dominant, that there's going to be a love connection. It doesn't mean that I don't care about subs or have some affinity, but it's not about a love connection. And there's this fantasy that if you don't propel that, they get all twisted. And my thing is, that's not the basis of DS anyway. So, it's a power exchange.
Yeah. And I think along those same lines, which causes just as many issues, is whilst all of them you have an independent relationship with, and every single dynamic you have is completely different and unique, what they sometimes either forget or don't want to acknowledge, because I can understand why they wouldn't want to acknowledge it, is that for the most part, you get the kind of dom tourists, but for the most part, they have one of you and you have 30 or 40 of them. So, of course, they're thinking about you all the time. They're thinking about how they can serve you, when they're next going to see you, what you did together. But whilst you have that time which you spend just with them, there are many of them all doing that. So they're not the only one who is texting you on Friday night. They're not the only one who is asking if you'll go for lunch with them the next day. They're not. And you have to divide your attention and affections and power between all of these men. And I think they sometimes forget that there's that kind of discrepancy between your two roles.
I think that's probably the most interesting thing about the pro-dom relationship construct. It's really an out of balance circumstance where you've got 30 people on one side and one on the other.
I know, but I was just taken when you said that. And I thought, well, it's that way because it's a socially, it's a way we look at women in this situation in dominance. But it's no different than all the years before we had the hottie-totty guy. I'm not even talking about someone who's in DS. I'm talking about Vanilla World. Okay. This hottie-totty guy who's like the hunk man, and he's dating 20 women. It's the same thing. He's juggling all those women because, again, they think they're his one or whatever, the interest, love interest, and he's playing the field. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but it's the same thing. But they often separate women out like, oh, this is so different for women, you know? And yeah. It isn't. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Great analogy.
Yeah. Well, Mistress Adrina, this has been a really fascinating conversation.
Oh, yeah.
Really appreciate you taking time to share your thoughts with us. So why don't you tell the listeners how to find you?
Oh, thank you. Right. The easiest way to do that would be via my website, which is www.mistressadrina.co.uk. My socials, my Instagram is very simple. It's just Adrina Angela. My Twitter, I am trying to remember. I believe it's Inanna Studio or Inanna London. That's not very helpful of me. One piece of advice, guys, if you do want to contact me, by all means, follow me on Instagram, say hey. If you want to talk about kink or a session, please contact me via my website, not Insta DM. We aren't teenagers. I'm not trying to, you know, slide into my DMs. So let's do it properly.
I love that. That's great. And I just thought, here we just talked about all these subs having access to you, and now we just opened up the whole world to your social media.
I just think, like, you know, when someone comes to you on Instagram and they're like, oh, I'm a sub, I want to be in front of you, blah, blah. It feels like a teenager on Snapchat trying to get me to show them your boobs. Like, that is not, it seems so too informal, you know, like to slide in someone's DMs to request a professional service or an intimate interaction. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, well, you've set the world straight. So thanks so much for coming on.
Absolute pleasure.
That's it for today. If you're interested in kinky relationship coaching, online domination, or if you'd like to sponsor the pod to keep it going, please visit our Patreon website at Lady Petra Playground. You can reach me via email at ladypetraplayground@gmail.com. Our music is composed and performed by Roger Ferguson, who can be found at rogerfergusonmusic.com. Till next time, cheers!